Did you notice two of the songs that we sang had the line, one day every tongue will confess you are God, and one day every knee will bow. Isn't that what we're praying for? Isn't that what we want to see? Isn't that what we've been doing over the last 6 or 7 years, praying again and again and again and again, that the Lord will rend the heavens and come down so that people will confess that Jesus is Lord and will confess and will bow. And I know one or two said on Wednesday that they're going to continue going through Revival Rain, because you don't get everything out of a book like that the first time round. This morning, I would like to look at, well, I'm going to, I'm sorry, I, not I like, but I'm going to look at the book of Esther. It's a bit of an action-packed adventure book, really. It's, you know, it has you a bit on the edge of your seat as to how is this all going to work out. And the story of Esther belongs to the period after the Babylonian exile, when Persia had replaced Babylon as the ruling power, as in that part of the world seems to happen with great regularity. The story set in Susa, one of the main Persian cities. And it's during the reign of King Ahasuerus, better known by his Greek name, Xerxes, which is not easy to keep typing on the computer. And at the time of Esther, some Jews had returned to Jerusalem, and others, like Esther and Mordecai, were still in exile. They were a minority group, and as is the case when you look back over history, being Jews, they are viewed with suspicion. They sometimes faced threats to their existence. But I'm not going to be looking at Esther. I'm actually going to be looking at Mordecai. And it's interesting to note that Esther is the only book in the Bible that does not mention God. But when you look at the story, you can see that Mordecai has a deep faith in God. So, at the start of the story, Xerxes' wife has failed to obey him, and to put it politely, has been put on one side. So the king is looking for a new wife and searches, you know, high and low, and it is Esther that is chosen. And chapter 2 of Esther, verses 5 to 7, tell us this. At that time, there was a Jewish man in the fortress of Susa, whose name was Mordecai, son of Jer. He was from the tribe of Benjamin and was a descendant of Kish and Shimei. His family had been among those who, with Jehoiakim of Judah, had been exiled from Jerusalem to Babylon by King Nebuchadnezzar. This man had a very beautiful and lovely young cousin, Hadassah, who was also called Esther. When her father and mother died, Mordecai adopted her into his family and raised her as his own daughter. We have no idea how old Mordecai was when Esther's parents died. We have no idea how old Esther was when her parents died. But what we are told is that he adopted her into his family, and she became a daughter for him, who he loved and cared for alongside all his other children. I say all his other children. He must have had other children, I suspect. I don't know. Speculation there. It's interesting to note that in Mordecai's ancestry, he is actually related to Saul, which is something we will come back to later on. But what I want to say, I want to look at five particular things that show Mordecai was a man of faith and integrity. But first of all, I want to look at what those two words mean. And if we look in Hebrews 11, chapter 1, which is a verse I'm sure many of us could quote, it says, and this is from the Amplified Version, "Now faith is the assurance, the confirmation, the title deed of the things we hope for, being the proof of things we do not see, and the conviction of their reality, faith perceiving as real fact what is not revealed to the senses." That's faith. And then the dictionary defines integrity as follows: the quality of being honest and having strong moral principles, righteousness, decency, sincerity, having a set of strong values and principles such as reliability, honesty, loyalty, and trustworthiness. Hopefully we're going to see those in Mordecai. So, Esther has been chosen as the new wife and now lives in the palace. And the first point I want to consider is this: Mordecai continued to watch and pray over Esther, even though his official responsibility of raising her was over. She now lived in the palace. She wasn't part of his household. But she was still his adopted daughter. And chapter 2, verse 10 and 11 tell us this: Esther had not told anyone of her nationality and family background because Mordecai had directed her not to do so for obvious safety reasons. Every day, Mordecai would take a walk near the courtyard of the harem to find out about Esther and what was happening to her. He wanted daily updates. It shows his love and his concern. He wanted his praying to be up to date. If something is happening, you want to know up to date what is happening so that you can pray effectively. She hadn't revealed her identity because of all the suspicion that surrounded Jews at that time. But he was continuing to look out for her welfare. Near the palace gate is not somewhere you can easily get to. So obviously, it's indicative that he is recognized as somebody who has a right to be there. Nobody challenges him being there. Secondly, he was a man of courage. Again in chapter 2, this time verses 21 and 22, it says this: "In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name, and then an inquiry was made into the matter. It was confirmed, and both men were hanged on a gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. The fact that he was sitting in the gate shows he held a position of trust and recognition. Daniel was also somebody who sat in the gate. Roughly 75 years later, Daniel 2:48 tells us, then the king appointed Daniel to a high position and gave him many valuable gifts. He made Daniel ruler over the whole province of Babylon, as well as chief over all his wise men. He had a right to sit in the gate. It was a place of recognition. And while he was there, Mordecai was listening. Possibly for things concerning Esther. And what were the people saying? How was she doing? But he heard this whisper of two doorkeepers wanting to take the king's life. He found a way to pass this information on to Esther. Esther passed it on to the king. The king took it seriously, as he should have done, because eventually he was assassinated. Mordecai's attitude was not one of, well, I'm a Jewish man in exile under a pagan king. It doesn't matter if he gets killed. He could have taken that attitude, but he didn't. In a sense, he anticipated what Peter says in 1 Peter 2:17, show proper respect to everyone. Love the family of believers, fear God, honor the emperor. Peter is telling believers that all people should be respected, no matter who they are, because all are made in the image of God. Esther informed the king. The result was the bodyguards were executed. They were the first of several plotters, apparently, to meet that end. And Mordecai, because she had credited Mordecai with giving her the information, Mordecai's deed was written into the Persian Chronicles. But contrary to normal practice, for some reason, no reward was given. But God had a reason why no reward was given. Thirdly, Mordecai did what was right, even when it could have cost him something. Chapter 3, verses 1 to 6 tells us this. Sometime later, King Xerxes promoted Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, over all the other nobles, making him the most powerful official in the empire. All the king's officials would bow down before Haman to show him respect whenever he passed by, for so the king had commanded. But Mordecai refused to bow down or show him respect. When the palace officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why are you disobeying the king's command?" They spoke to him day after day, but still he refused to comply with the order. So they spoke to Haman about this to see if he would tolerate Mordecai's conduct. What a bunch of stirrers. Why aren't you doing it, Mordecai? The king commanded it. I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it. Do you know he's not bowing down? What a bunch of stirrers. I don't know. But it's all in God's plan. Mordecai had told them he was a Jew. He would bow down to no man, because that may well be interpreted as worship. He would worship the Lord his God only. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not bow down or show him respect, he was filled with rage. He had learned of Mordecai's nationality, so he decided it was not enough to lay hands on Mordecai alone. Instead, he looked for a way to destroy all the Jews throughout the entire empire of Xerxes. This man has a few issues. You know, he doesn't just go after Mordecai. He goes after the whole Jewish nation. This is possibly 3 or 4 years after Mordecai exposed the assassination plot, but the story doesn't give us a reason why Haman was given the promotion. He was clearly an ungodly man, but God had a purpose in allowing him to be promoted. It says he is the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Now, this possibly makes him a descendant of King Agag, the king of the Amalekites, who were Israel's sworn enemy. Exodus 17:14-16 tells us this. After the victory, the Lord instructed Moses, write this down on a scroll as a permanent reminder and read it aloud to Joshua. I will erase the memory of Amalek from under the heaven. Moses built an altar there and named it Yahweh Nisi, which means the Lord is my banner. He said, they have raised their fist against the Lord's throne, so now the Lord will be at war with Amalek generation after generation. But then later in 1 Samuel 15:9, we read this. Saul and his men spared Agag's life and kept the best of the sheep and the goats, the cattle, the fat calves and the lambs, everything, in fact, that appealed to them. They destroyed only what was worthless or of poor quality. This was in total disobedience to what God had commanded, which was the complete destruction of all the property, flocks, and people. And as we've seen, Esther chapter 2 verse 5 tells us of Mordecai's connection to Saul. So there's this long-held antagonism between Israel and Amalek. And is it about to be played out again? Haman is presented as vain, perhaps someone lacking popular support, since the king needed to command that the people bow before him. Something that bowing before nobles and so on regularly happened in that country, in that culture. But Mordecai didn't bow. Though, as I've said, Haman seems not to have noticed. And central to this is the fact that Mordecai was a Jew. He would honour those in authority, but not worshipped. So Haman decides to destroy all the Jews in the empire. You could say, what Saul had not done to Agag, Agag's descendants would do to the Jews. So Haman went to the king and persuaded him to have all the Jews destroyed because they kept themselves to themselves, they kept themselves separate, didn't obey the king's laws. But really, it was only one man. And when Mordecai hears of Haman's plans, he's needless to say, he's distraught. So the fourth thing we see is that Mordecai challenged Esther to stay true to her people and her faith, even if it meant endangering her life. Mordecai turned to Esther for help. She sent a servant to find out what the problem was. And Mordecai told the servant the whole story. Chapter 4, verse 13 says, Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do not think that in your heart that you will escape the king in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews." In other words, first and foremost, Esther, you are a Jew. Don't think that because you happened to be the beautiful young woman that the king decided to marry, that that is going to save you. This applies to you. Because as much as anybody living anywhere in the empire, first and foremost, you are a Jew. But fifthly, hot on its heels, comes that he trusted God's sovereignty and recognized that God uses people to accomplish his will. The very next verse in chapter 4, so verse 14, says, "If you keep quiet at a time like this, deliverance and relief for the Jews will arise from some other place, but you and your relatives will die. Who knows if perhaps you were made queen for such a time as this?" Mordecai's trust was in the faithfulness of God, not in the faithfulness of Esther. Because he says that relief will arise from some other place. If you don't do it, God's going to send somebody else. Or maybe God's going to have to send somebody else. He knows God will not let his people down, even if individuals do. Mordecai reminds her that the fate of the people, God's chosen people, rested on God, not on her, but her own faith, her own fate, rather, depended on her faithfulness to God. Maybe Mordecai was thinking, did God raise this orphan to the elevated place of the palace for a reason? God doesn't do anything without a reason. And Esther needs the courage and the wisdom to see that reason and fulfill it. So, Esther is convinced and tells Mordecai to gather all the Jews in Susa and ask them to fast for her for 3 days, and she will do the same. Then she takes action. She decides to go to the king. Going to the king without invitation could result in her death. He's on his throne, he sees her at the open door, and he has a choice. He can extend his scepter or not. If he does, she can approach. If he doesn't, it probably means death. You came into the presence of the king at his invitation. We come into the presence of our king at his invitation, but we know he will always hold out the scepter to welcome us. We don't have to stand at the open door with the fear that Esther had. She approached She didn't have anything to lose. If she didn't do this, she would be dead one way or the other. You know, it's a bit of devil in deep blue sea, really, isn't it? She invited the king and Haman to dine. That night, they dined. He said, "What do you want?" She said, "Will you come and dine with me tomorrow?" "Yes." Haman didn't really, I don't think, had have a choice. If invited by the queen and the king says yes, you have to go as well if you're invited. You know, this is a bit of a three-line whip for him. But during the night between, Xerxes couldn't sleep very well. So he decided to ask for the history of his reign, a little night reading. And as he's reading, he finds where it's recorded that Mordecai had saved his life. So he asks, you know, you've always got to, if you're up there, you know, if you're the king of an empire, even if you're up in the middle of the night, there's still attendants around. They're not allowed to sleep. He asked what had been done. And they went, "Well, actually, sir, nothing." I suspect he thought, "Well, we're going to have to put that right then, aren't we?" Come the morning, he sees Haman, says to Haman, in chapter 6, verse 6, what Haman would suggest that he had done for someone who has truly pleased me, which obviously Mordecai had. Now, as I've already said, I think Haman's a bit of a, you know, a less than pleasant character. I can imagine Haman going, "Oh, yes, oh yes, the king wants to honour me. What am I going to suggest?" So he suggests all sorts of things. And the king says, "Great. Go and do it for Mordecai." Can you imagine the look on Haman's face? "Yes, sire. You know, I will obey through gritted teeth. This is not what I thought." So he has to set this in motion. Evening comes, and they go to dinner with Esther. And at this second banquet, she pleads for the life of her people. And she explains what has been going on. And you can imagine Haman sitting there thinking, "I wish I could get out of this. I don't think this is looking very good for me." And the king leaves, and Haman decides it's a good idea to plead for his life. However, his action is totally misinterpreted. It is interpreted as an attempted assault on Esther. Needless to say, the king is not happy. You know, he probably wasn't happy when he left the banquet. Now he's heard all this kerfuffle as he's leaving, he's even less happy. The upshot is, the death that Haman had planned for Mordecai becomes his own. And then there is the issue of the order that Haman got the king to sign. It cannot be rescinded. So he sends out another one that says, actually, the Jews are allowed to take up arms. He makes sure that Mordecai is promoted. People of any authority across the empire hear Mordecai has been promoted, get to understand what's going on, and think, well, actually, maybe the king doesn't want us to slaughter the Jews. Some places it did happen, but the Jews fought back and slaughtered thousands. And that celebration within Judaism is the Feast of Purim, which, if you are ever in a synagogue during the Feast of Purim, is the noisiest service there is. There are bells and there are whistles and there are rattles whenever Mordecai's mentioned, and there are boos whenever Haman is mentioned. The kids get really involved. I've seen a glimpse on a video when I've been teaching. It's quite fun. So, how does this apply to us? When Mordecai's official responsibility of raising Esther was over, he continued to seek her welfare. He continued to pray for her. Are we faithful in praying for those we have who have responsibility over us, or we have responsibility to pray for? These five questions I'm asking me as much as anybody else. What about our children, our grandchildren, our neighbours, our government, our church leaders? Paul tells us in 1 Timothy 2, I urge you, first of all, to pray for all people. Ask God to help them. Intercede on their behalf and give thanks for them. Pray this way for kings and all who are in authority, so that we can live peaceful and quiet lives marked by godliness and dignity. Do we do that? Secondly, he was a man of courage. How courageous are we? Do we take the step of offering to pray for someone who we've been chatting to at the bus stop, in the shops, or in the coffee queue, or the doctor's surgery, or, you know, wherever we happen to see them? Do we have the courage to speak out against injustice? Do we have the courage to show compassion for those in need? We heard from Jackie the other week about her chatting to a young homeless man. Hopefully, that's led him to finding accommodation, but maybe more than that. We don't know. He did what was right, even when it cost him something. Are we prepared to take a stand in a world which is becoming increasingly hostile? When we are required to do something which is against the law, what do we do? Or rather, against the law of God, what do we do? I know at least one guy who lost his job, or was threatened with losing his job, too, actually. You know, if you don't do this. One young man said to his bosses, if you carry on behaving like this in a financial way which was not right, I am going to report you to the authorities. Their response was, shut up. We're not interested. This is worth thousands to us. But he said, you do it again, I will do it. They continued in the same way. God bless that young man. He'd got a new job before that job fired him. It could have cost him something, but God went on to bless him. Do we, as it says in Matthew 5, let our yes be yes and our no be no? Yes, this is right. No, that is not. He challenged Esther to stay true to her people and her faith, even if it meant endangering her life. Are we prepared to stand up and defend God's word, his principles, his people? I had not heard, before we started doing Revival Rain, I had not heard of the North Korean revival. The vast majority of Christians in North Korea are in labor camps. The small percentage of believers who are not live in 24-hour fear of a knock on the door. And yet they're staying true to the Lord. We need to make sure we don't compromise or blend in, fit in, get squashed into the world's mold rather than do what is right. Mordecai trusted God's sovereignty, but also recognized that he uses people to accomplish his will. It may be us that God is using to accomplish his will. I hope it is. Or it may be others we know in a particular situation. We cannot assume that we know what God's plan is for people's lives. But we can remind them of the truth of Scripture and encourage them to step out in faith in order that they may know their destiny in God. God brought deliverance to the Jewish people through Esther's courage. But she needed the advice, counsel, and guidance from Mordecai in her life. And that advice, counsel, and guidance came from his faith in God. Mordecai was available for God to use. If he had not taken on the role of looking after Esther, things could have looked very different. The book probably wouldn't have been called Esther for a start. God would still have saved and looked after his chosen people. Mordecai was willing to be used, and it led to the salvation of the Jewish people, despite one man's desire to destroy them. And I really didn't know how to end this. And then I found a quote from Spurgeon. He says, "Have you been wishing for another position where you could do something for Jesus? Don't wish anything of the kind, but serve him where you are." And I thought, he could have added, just like Mordecai did. God puts us where we are to serve him where we are. May we all seek to do that more and more each day. Amen.